to the Grey Lords in residence, Z should know who they are, and if not, Uncle Mike will, and request a face-to-face meeting. Get the reaction of the governing body, Z snorted, to our rescue of Aiden, killing of the troll, and protection for Z and Tad straight from the horse's mouth.
If you request a meeting, said Tad, it puts them in the driver's seat.
They win the dominance fight, Adam agreed. But it is the only way we know we are dealing with the people in charge.
Z grunted. Wait a minute, I said. Wait a minute. I looked at Adam. Thomas Howe is meeting with the Grey Lords tonight in Walla Walla. We might be able to finagle the definition of some guesting laws so that we could attend that meeting. Since we are in the process of defining what our duties for our territory are right now, they're pretty fluid. Adam laughed, but quietly, because Aiden had fallen into an exhausted sleep. I'd seen things like that happen with the wolves sometimes, mostly while I'd lived with the Maroc. He took in the wolves who needed help, whatever the reason. Some of them arrived in really bad shape, mentally and physically. In Bran's touch, they found safety. Sleep would come and just knock them off their feet.
Fluid duties is right, Adam agreed. Would the Grey Lords Thomas is meeting with be able to negotiate with us?
I don't know, I said, but I bet Z will.
Thomas Howe is a vampire, said Z.
I nodded, but that's not who the Fae are interested in. I told them all about our early morning call and whom we'd found when we went visiting Wolf's stray vampire. Z bowed his head when I was finished.
The dragon under the hill is dead, he said heavily. I had not heard. So many of my old enemies are no more.
He gave me a wry look.
Happily, there seem to be adequate replacements ready and waiting.
Her father was really a dragon? I asked.
The dragon under the hill is a title. The Flanagan was not a dragon in that sense, said Z. He was a powerful Fey lord whose elements were both fire and earth, in a way that was similar to the Red Dragon of Cymri, who was, for all I know still is, a true dragon.
So, said Adam. He moved Aiden around until the boy's legs dangled limply off one side of Adam's lap.
Assuming Thomas and Margaret agree to our joining them, we have several options. We can call the number on the note, then go to Walla Walla with Thomas and his Fae to negotiate with the Grey Lords. We cannot call the number on the note and still go to Walla Walla. We can ignore the Fae entirely.
I would not recommend that last, said Z, not as long as we have bargaining room.
Do we? Asked Tad in a raw voice. What would you bargain?
He looked around the room at us.
Dad bargained his safety for mine. They twisted that and tortured my father to get my cooperation.
Z smiled.
Which you didn't give them.
I would have, snarled Tad. Don't think I wouldn't have, old man. But you told me you had a plan. You didn't tell me it would take 2 weeks.
Z patted Tad's shoulder.
If you had not held out, all would have failed. As it is, we are safe with allies, and I will deal with those responsible in such a way that it will not happen again.
Silence fell.
We were talking about bargaining room, Z said, sounding almost kindly. You probably won't know what you have until you talk to them.
I won't hand Aiden over to them, Adam said, nor stand by while you or Tad are taken.
There's some room between what we will do and what we won't, I said. Should I call Thomas? I didn't have his phone number, but I could call the hotel.
Your justification for escorting the Flanagan and her vampire is that they are in your territory?
Z asked.
How big is your territory, Adam?
As big as I can defend, Adam said, his eyes hooded.
If there is a war, I will take it right to the door of Underhill should it be necessary. They will not find us an easy enemy to defeat.
Cost them so much in the winning that they never do it again, said Z thoughtfully.
That is a tactic. Not a good one, but a tactic. Usually the result is a Pyrrhic victory.
Adam nodded.
Let's just hope that someone other than you remembers that and they don't force us to go to war.
Or we can just refer to the guesting laws, I said.
Guests can request help in their journey without us claiming Walla Walla as our territory. It's stretching the rules a little, but not changing the letter of the law.
Guesting laws aside, Adam took a deep breath and gave a decisive nod. The first thing we really need is information. And I have one place we can get more without risking anyone.
He hitched his hip up off the chair and pulled his cell phone out of his pocket.
So I vote that we see what our note writers want first.
He dialed, then set the phone on the table with the speaker on, apparently done with his nod to democracy. It rang three times and stopped. I could hear breathing on the other side of the connection. They waited for us to speak, but that's not how an alpha plays the game. Eventually, a voice that could have been a high-pitched man's or a low-pitched female's said tentatively,
"Who calls?"
Aiden jerked awake at the sound of the voice and dug his hands into Adam's arms, then slid off his lap and backed into a corner of the kitchen. Z knew the voice on the phone, too. His eyes narrowed and he pursed his lips, but he nodded at Adam.
"You give this number to a lot of people?" Adam asked.
"Mr. Hauptmann," said the voice, the tentative quality disappearing, buried in cold confidence. It was a woman's voice, I decided. "We do not desire a war with you."
"Could have fooled me," he growled. "You set a troll on my city."
There was a pause.
"Your city," she said. "I believe you are the alpha of the Columbia Basin Pack, not the mayor of Richland, Pasco, or Kent. Ken.
Adam smiled in satisfaction.
"Kennewick," he said, "is the name you're looking for. And my territory is where I say it is."
"What your woman says it is,"
she snapped, implying I thought that the power in the pack was not Adam, but me.
"Exactly so," agreed Adam to my surprise.
I wasn't the only one. Tad looked at me with an odd expression.
"She is my mate and speaks with my voice. It doesn't sound as though we can work together. You are wasting my time."
He reached out and hit end, cutting off the call. Aiden said,
"It is dangerous to play games with them."
His shoulders were hunched, and he did not look at any of us.
"Especially dangerous with that one."
Tad murmured, "Listen to Captain Obvious." That earned him a quelling glance from Adam. I started to ask Aiden or Z just who we were dealing with, but Adam spoke first.
"We are dangerous too," my husband told Aiden, not unkindly. "They need to remember that."
He looked at Z.
"How long do you think she'll wait before calling back?"
Z pursed his lips.
"It depends upon how much she wants."
The phone buzzed, and Adam glanced at the screen.
"Apparently quite a lot," he said.
He hit the green button on the screen and set it back down on the table.
"You have something I want," she said.
I frowned at Adam. And he nodded. He'd caught her change from the "we" of the note to "I."
"You've said that before," Adam said. "I probably have several things you want. Pick one."
"The boy," she said.
"No dice."
Adam hit the red button, and we all waited. Aiden stared at the floor and wrapped his arms around himself.
"Adam offered you indefinite protection," Tad told Aiden. "You probably missed it in the middle of your panic attack. But he won't allow you to be given to the Fae against your will. Not ever. Nicely played."
Aiden opened his mouth. The phone rang again. Adam touched the green button and said,
"You bore me."
"I need the boy," she said.
"And you offer?"
"The note told you we are willing to allow you your territory."
His body relaxing like a cat's, Adam smiled, his teeth white and even.
"So the note said."
His voice was very soft.
"No one allows me anything."
He paused and continued in a more normal tone.
"That doesn't mean we can't negotiate. What are you yourself willing to offer me, and why are you answering this phone instead of whoever wrote those notes?"
The Fidel was male, and I would have recognized his voice. The woman might have been working with him, or some group of Fae. But she was trying to work out a deal alone. Adam had just let her know that he understood that. she responded with silence. Hard to tell if she was panicking or just thinking.
They can lie, Adam told her conversationally, but I understand that they are punished for it, removed from all that is and was and could be, a curse of rare power levied against your race by those who went before.
I raised my eyebrows. I didn't know that. Z focused intently on Adam. I assumed that Z knew that Faye could lie, but wanted to know where Adam had gotten his information.
You will regret, she spat, but Adam had already disconnected his phone. Well, that one wants you, Aiden, Adam said. But as entertaining as that phone call was, we didn't learn what the Fae as a whole want. Who was she, Z?
The Widow Queen, he said. Neuth. She has other names. The Black Queen.
A Fairy Queen? I asked. I'd met one of them.
But Z shook his head. No, she's She-Fae, a Grey Lord. She likes to play with the humans, though, causing misery, which she can feed upon. She made her way into more than one folktale. I'd heard that she was at the one in Nevada. I did not see her while I was at our local reservation.
Aiden shook his head. No, she is here. She... He took a deep breath.
No. She was one of the ones who came here when I escaped Underhill and was recaptured by the Fae.
Tell me about her, said Adam.
Z frowned. It was Tad who said,
In the far past, the Widow Queen was known for seducing men, men powerful in the human world, but also good and beloved men. Gradually, she would separate them from everything they loved until they were obsessed with her. She could use magic to accomplish this, but preferred not. It was better when they followed her of their own will. Then she would destroy the man, the people he once loved, physically, mentally, in all ways at her disposal, then move on to the lands he ruled. The stories of Snow White and Cinderella probably were first conceived as a result of incidents involving her. When Underhill closed, she lost a great deal of that kind of magic, and more to the point, she lost her ability to feed off human misery. That wasn't her greatest power. She is a Grey Lord, but she enjoyed it the most.
So why would she want Aiden? I asked. Then answered myself, Beloved of Underhill, right? Possessed of magic she bestowed upon him, and the Widow Queen wants her abilities back.
Tad shrugged. Z grunted. Good enough supposition, I read from the vague noises. At least she doesn't prey upon children, Adam murmured with a sigh. So now we know that one Fae wants Aiden. We need a plan for tonight. Will the Grey Lord's meeting with Thomas's Fae be of sufficient status to bargain?
He looked at Z, who sighed.
Probably. The Flanagan was a power, and his daughter showed signs of being the same.
He tapped on the table.
You should bargain with them that they respect the boundaries of your territory, and be very clear what your territory is. Too big? And they will not believe you can hold it. Too small, and you tell them that you are weak.
What do we have to bargain with? Adam asked. I won't turn the boy over to them.
He looked at Tad.
Or you or your father. Bran has made it clear that we are on our own.
There's the walking stick, I said.
That's a non-starter, said Adam. It won't stay with them in the first place. And in the second place...
Yeah, I agreed. It's changed, hasn't it? It's not just an artifact anymore. It has a mind of its own, which makes it not something I'm willing to bargain with, if I can help it. 8. Thomas had been suspiciously amiable about my request to include us in his Fae Ladies meeting.
I am, he said when I'd called him, very happy to have more security for Margaret.
I cleared my throat. You might not be so happy when I explain exactly why we'd like to come along. He listened as I expanded on the tale of the trouble I'd caused with my little speech on the bridge.
So, he said when I'd finished, you wish to come in the hopes of taking the Grey Lords by surprise, and are fairly sure that those Fae you will corner are people who know the situation and have the power to make bargains.
Yes, I said. There was a little pause. You don't think that the Grey Lords are responsible for the threatening message sent to Hauptmann's ex-wife? Worse, you don't think that the person, this Widow Queen you talked to on the phone, was the person responsible for the message either?
She may have been one of them, I said, but there are others who may or may not have a different agenda than she does. Or they want our refugee too, but not for the same purpose. You see our problem?
You don't know who wants what, and where they sit in the halls of power.
Margaret Flanagan had taken the phone.
Too many possibilities, and not enough information.
Exactly, I told her. We don't want war with the Fae, and I don't think they want war with us either. But we won't give them the boy who has been a victim of the Fae for a very long time. We won't give them...
I paused, because in this instance I probably couldn't speak for the pack.
I won't give them Z or his son. Ideally, the Grey Lords will decide we are too much trouble or not important enough to screw with, and they will take over and police their own. Otherwise, we'll try to bargain with them to get them to respect our territorial boundaries.
Z, Margaret asked, you said his name to Thomas, too, as if he were someone we should know.
Zebold Adalbert Smiter, I said. He said a lot of names over the years. You might know him better as the Dark Smith of Trondheim.
There was a long pause.
You are a friend of the Dark Smith?
Z is a grumpy old fae, I said, but he is my friend.
She drew in a breath.
He was my father's much-admired enemy.
If it helps, I said, when I told him your father was dead, it hit him pretty hard. I'd say the admiration went both ways.
She laughed.
Thomas said,
Margaret is what is important.
We will protect her, I said.
All right, he said. But you come, you and your mate. I've met you, and I'll have you at my back, but no strangers.
Deal, I said. Which is how I came to be riding shotgun instead of someone more useful like Warren or Honey, but we were hoping this wouldn't turn into an actual battle.
Z came too.
I hadn't asked him. Adam hadn't asked him. Z hadn't said anything. He'd just been sitting in the back seat of Adam's car when we were ready to leave. He wouldn't say anything, and he wouldn't get out. None of the other cars parked at the house would start. So, instead of being late, we drove to the hotel with him in the back seat. Thomas and Margaret came out to meet us. The sky wasn't quite dark, and Thomas wore gloves and a black hoodie with the hood pulled over his head. The hoodie made him look smaller and less dangerous, more like a gang member and less like a vampire. Adam started to explain our stowaway to Thomas, but Z got out of the car and looked at Margaret. He frowned at the crutches and the scars on her wrists.
Your father was an honorable enemy, he told her. He deserved better followers. Are you as tough as your father?
She raised her chin, but it was Thomas who said,
Tougher. They were both trapped underground in mining tunnels for decades. He died, and she survived.
My father was injured, she said sharply. I was not.
I did not know about this imprisonment, Z said, or I would have put a stop to it. I heard only afterward how it happened that you were trapped by those who should have cared for you.
He raised his eyes to her.
I would have broken my old enemy out of a prison he did not deserve, if only to ensure that a worthy opponent still walked the earth. For the error of my ignorance, I will do my best to make sure that his daughter walks away unharmed today.
She looked at him.
That's not why you came here, she said.
It is, he said, but it isn't the only reason, nor the most important until I saw your face. The dragon under the hill lives in your face. You have his eyes. Your father was one of the few enemies I had who was capable of giving as good as he got. He fought with cunning, skill, and honor. Those three qualities are seldom found together. I disagreed with him and he annoyed me, but he was a worthy opponent. I have other reasons to speak to the Grey Lords, but your safety will be my primary concern.
They faced off with each other, the delicate woman with her scars and her crutches, and the wiry old man with his bald patch in his pot belly.
Say no, said Thomas. Sunshine, he is dangerous.
So am I, she said, but gently.
So are we all, isn't that the truth?
But he is more dangerous to our enemies.
She frowned at Z.
You aren't what I expected from the stories.
He glanced around the parking lot, then back at her.
This is a different time.
He shrugged, the movement a little shallower than his usual shrug, but she wouldn't know that.
I see, said Margaret. I agree to your unexpected proposal, Smith.
You aren't riding in the car with him, Thomas said.
She smiled at Thomas.
All right, we'll take both cars.
She looked at me.
I'd like some time to talk with you.
She glanced at her vampire guardian, then at Adam.
I think we have a lot in common, and I'd like to compare notes.
I had hoped we'd all have a chance to talk on the way to Walla Walla. Maybe we can get together before you leave? I asked. She nodded gravely.
I hope so.
Walla Walla was a term the Nez Perce used for a place where a stream flowed into a larger stream, or so I was told, though probably the pronunciation had changed quite a bit from the original. The most common translation was many waters, probably because it was both shorter and more lyrical than where a stream flows into a bigger stream. Walla Walla was a town of a little over 30,000 people, though it felt smaller than that somehow. I think it was the old-fashioned feel of the downtown district, an atmosphere invoking the days of horse and buggy or Model T cars. It was a kind of town that got voted most friendly, most picturesque, or best place to live on a regular basis. Despite its many fine qualities, before the Ronald Wilson Reagan Fay Reservation was plunked down west of the town, Walla Walla was most famous for the nearby site of the Whitman Mission. There, the Protestant missionary Dr. Marcus Whitman, his wife Narcissa, and 12 other white people living at the mission were killed by Cayuse Indians in the middle of the 19th century. Whitman was a doctor and a missionary, and he gained a reputation in the local tribes, Walla Walla, Nez Perce, and Cayuse mostly, as a spiritual leader and a man of powerful medicine. When measles swept through the Cayuse tribe, they turned to him for help he could not provide. The disaster that ensued was not, strictly speaking, the fault of either the Cayuse or the Whitmans, who were all doing what they believed to be right. The symbolic irony of this meeting between werewolf, vampire, and fae at a hotel named after Marcus Whitman did not go over my head. I hoped our results were better than those Whitman and the Cayuse achieved. The road to Walla Walla was one of those winding highways that meandered through small towns along the way instead of speeding right past them with nothing more than an exit to mark their place. As I rode shotgun next to Adam, following Thomas Howe's white Subaru down the narrow highway to Walla Walla, we passed the road that used to lead to the Fay Reservation. "How do you want to play this?" I asked Adam, abruptly tired of the quiet in the car. I felt itchy with readiness, and the quiet, centered calm in both men irritated me.
"Nothing to plan," he said.
When I snorted, he grinned at me. It wasn't a light-hearted grin, but there was amusement in it.
"There is no reason to overthink things, Mercy. We don't know who we're going to see or what they are going to say. We can't plan except in the most general of fashions. We'll let Margaret get her say in first. That's courtesy. We'll work our business in as we can. Probably that will be very short and sweet for our part. We'll let them tell us what they are looking for if it gets that far. That part is up to them as well. It may be that we all just snap threats at each other and go home. I won't know how to play it until we at least know who we're playing with."
He was right. I knew he was right. But I needed something to do, something to think about, so I could quit scaring myself with what-ifs, even if that meant talking about what-ifs. Adam was very good at making them less scary than my imagination did.
"There are only a few things we know for certain," he said, as if he could hear my restlessness. "Z isn't going to let anything happen to Margaret. Thomas can take care of himself."
Then his voice dropped into a low, dangerous tone that was nothing like the easy, relaxed attitude he'd been portraying.
"And nothing is getting past me to you."
I absorbed that. The tone, not the words or intent behind it, those I already knew. Part of the magic of his voice was a southern softness that blurred his consonants even when his accent wasn't strong. Part of it was the reliable confidence behind every word. I just knew there was no guile, give, or hesitation in this man the first time I heard him speak. At the time, it had been frustrating and annoying. But mostly, when he dropped his voice that way, it caressed something inside me, like he'd stroked the back of my neck without touching me. It made me want to melt into a puddle at his feet and settled my restlessness right down. He knew it, too. He smiled a little and turned his attention back to driving. I glanced at Z. How about you? Are you planning or running by the seat of your pants, too? Z smiled happily. Somehow it was worse than his usual tightly sour smile, even though the happy was real. Maybe it was because the happy was real.
I will keep my old enemy's daughter safe. Sometime soon, I will deal with the Fae who have offended me in such a way that others avoid annoying me for another century or two. That's a good plan for the next few weeks, I think. Findest du nicht auch?
He didn't really expect an answer. Don't you find it so is usually a rhetorical question, especially with Z, who seldom cares for other people's opinions at the best of times. We drove for a while longer, and I got restless again. Maybe if I started fidgeting, Adam would let me drive. Maybe someone could start a conversation so I would quit worrying about how wrong this night could go. Why so quiet? I asked Adam.
I'm planning my moves, he said. I think I'll walk to the left of Thomas and Margaret. Studies show that right-handed people look right before they look left. That will give me a psychological advantage. Then I'll walk at half speed.
I could smack you, I said. Just saying.
I'm driving, he answered meekly, and you shouldn't hurt the one you love. Flirt on your own time, Lieblings, advised Z. I am too old for it. You could give me a heart attack.
You'd have to have a heart for that threat to work, I said, and happily settled in for a game of insults with Z. We parked next to Thomas's car. It was nearly full dark, close enough to it that the vampire had discarded his hoodie and stood looking elegant in his usual bright-colored silk shirt. This one was an iridescent pearly blue, with an embroidered dark blue or black dragon crawling over his shoulder and down his arm. He opened the door for Margaret and stood watching her struggle to get out. He didn't move a muscle, but I could feel the willpower it took not to help. Adam was right. Thomas was a goner. People who say that vampires don't care about anyone except themselves are mostly right, but sometimes they are very and lethally wrong. Margaret's pain was too private to watch, so I looked up at the hotel. In downtown Seattle, the Marcus Whitman Hotel wouldn't stand out, but in Walla Walla, it was about 100 feet taller than anything else around it. From the bones of the original structure, it had been built in the late 1920s. Several colors of brick and the very modern entrance evidenced more than one renovation over the years. All right, Margaret said, her voice a little husky from pain. There are supposed to be 3 Grey Lords meeting with me, and I'm allowed to bring my people with me. I had intended it to be just Thomas, but they allowed me 6. With your permission, I'm going to give you, Adam and Mercy, a little glamour, nothing fancy, just something that will help them dismiss you as thugs numbers 1 and 2. If you do something to draw attention, the glamour won't hold. She looked at Z. You, I expect, can do your own and be thug number 3. She turned back to Adam and me. It won't hold if they really look at you, but it should give us the element of surprise, and any advantage is to your favor. They'll respect you for it.
Fine, said Adam.
I nodded. Her magic settled over me like a cool mist. Sometimes magic doesn't stick to me, but this time it seemed to. Thomas, I asked. He doesn't need it, she said. He can do it without magic. When he doesn't want people to notice him, they just don't. I rubbed my pleasantly tingling skin and said, You're just going in to tell them no, right? Which you could do with just Thomas. The glamour is to help us? She smiled. It's fun. I don't like them. Don't like the games they are playing.
I'm happy to help. Now hush. Someone could be listening. Probably not, I said. I would smell anyone close enough to listen.
Thomas looked at me as though I were interesting. Better than a werewolf?
For fey and magic, yes, I told him. To be fair, there is a lot of ambient noise right now. Someone would have to be very close to overhear us.
I didn't tell them that fey glamour might be awesomely powerful, but it seldom worked on scent. Let them think I was special. We walked into the hotel following Margaret. She didn't travel fast, but no one evinced the slightest impatience. Adam took the left rear position. I don't know if he did it for the reasons he told me in the car, or if that was just where he happened to be. Z took the right rear. Thomas walked in front of Adam, and I took the leftover spot next to Thomas. Inside, the lobby was overflowing with beige tuxes and unflattering teal gowns. They were mostly densely clustered near the bride, recognizable as such by her 30s-style off-white lace gown. She was patting the back of a middle-aged woman in a bright green sparkly suit who was sobbing on the bride's shoulder. The whole lobby was trying not to watch, and so no one noticed us at all. As if she'd been in the hotel 100 times, Margaret headed for one of the banks of elevators. We waited in silence for the doors to slide open. When they did, we stepped inside. It was a tight squeeze. The elevators weren't built for a fairy princess and her guards. Fortunately, it was a fast elevator, and we got off on the second floor. Margaret headed down the hallway, and we spread out behind her like a wedding train. She passed a couple of doors on her left before opening the door on her right, discreetly marked Walla Walla. She waited while we flowed around her to precede her into the room. There was a conference table, and someone, maybe the hotel, had put bright bouquets of carnations in shades of red on either end of the long table. 5 people were already seated on the side of the table that faced the entry door. 2 more stood against the far wall in parade rest. All of the fae were wearing their human glamour. I knew some of them. Beauclair, the handsome former lawyer who declared fae independence, was seated on the far left. Next to him was a dark-haired woman whose sunglasses concealed her blind eyes. Nemaine, the Morrigan, who'd once been the Irish goddess of battle. I didn't know the man next to her. He was pale-skinned, bald and fine-boned, with bulging eyes and broken blood vessels on the sides of his nose that were so bad it was almost hard to focus on anything else. Next to him was an extraordinarily beautiful woman with childlike features, porcelain skin, and deep red lips. The final seated person was a middle-aged woman who was comfortably plump and clothed in a badly fitting 3-piece business suit in salmon pink. Her hair was gray and brown, and her features were absolutely unremarkable. The 2 people who stood before the wall were Uncle Mike and Edith, who I still thought of as Yo-Yo Girl, because the first time I'd seen her, she'd been playing with a yo-yo. Edith looked like a young girl. Like Aiden, she appeared to be somewhere between 9 and 11. Unlike Aiden, she chose that guise because she enjoyed looking like a victim, which she very much wasn't. I'd seen her do some scary stuff and watched other fae skittle out of her path. She met my eyes and gave me an ironic lift of an eyebrow. Apparently Margaret's magic wasn't working for her. The 2 Grey Lords who knew me looked past me without the hesitation that they'd have given if they'd really seen me, and so did Uncle Mike. I filed Edith's immunity in the mental file I kept marked, Why Edith, Yo-Yo Girl, is Scary. It was a big file. Margaret looked at the 5 people seated on the opposite side of the table, letting her gaze linger meaningfully on the last 2.
You told me there were to be 3 of you, Margaret said coolly. Do the fae negotiate in falsehoods now?
It's my fault, Margaret, said the beautiful woman in a husky voice that I'd last heard coming out of Adam's phone a few hours earlier. I was visiting this reservation and heard that you were expected. My associate, she touched the middle-aged woman's arm lightly, and I asked to be included for old time's sake. I once knew your father very well, and I couldn't resist the chance to see his daughter.
Margaret spread her hands, as if to display herself.
As you now do.
You look bad, said the man who sat in the middle seat.
His voice, high and fussy, fit his outwardly meek appearance.
You need to come home with us, and we will see you restored to your proper self. It's been several years since the incident, hasn't it? So it is obvious that you need help to recover from your ordeal.
Margaret directed her attention at him, even as she waved a hand over her shoulder at us, and we four spread out on the wall behind her. The door was on the far left-hand side of the wall, so we didn't have to worry about anyone's coming in from outside between us. She walked with painful slowness, more slowly than I'd seen her move before, in fact. When she reached the table, she pulled out a chair left of the middle, directly in front of Nemain. I couldn't tell if it was deliberate, or if the chair was closer to the door so she didn't have to walk so far. She took her time seating herself and arranging her crutches so that everyone in the room could see just how crippled she was. Only when she was comfortably seated in the leather executive chair did she speak.
"Incident," she said. "What a curious word. Incident. So bland and small. I truly appreciate your words, Garau, but I think not. I am healing at precisely the correct rate for full recovery."
Garau. I should remember something about that name. I've been reading a lot of stories about the Fae lately. Garau sounded like it should be French, but I was thinking it came from the Mabinogian, which was Welsh.
"You are Fae," said the beautiful woman. "You belong to us."
I couldn't see Margaret's expression since I was directly behind her, but a raised eyebrow was evident in her voice anyway.
"Curious choice of words. I do not belong to you."
"You are Fae, child," said Nemain.
She took a deep breath through her nose, tilted her head in a bird-like gesture, and smiled at me. She couldn't see me, but Nemain didn't need her eyes for much. She chose not to say anything. My dealings with her had been almost friendly, but she wasn't an ally. Instead of asking Margaret why she'd brought the Alpha of the Columbia Basin Pack and his mate to a Fae meeting, she said carefully,
"Newt chose her words poorly. You belong with us."
"You think so, do you?" asked Margaret. "I disagree, which I have explained in several letters, emails, and two phone calls if you count the one where I hung up on the council representative. I am here now to explain it in person. I will not go. I will not put myself in your power. I have been under the power of the Fae before, and I will not do it again."
"You are Fae," Beauclair began carefully, but Garau went on the attack before Beauclair could make his point.
"You think you can resist us?" asked Garau,
though I don't think he meant it as a question. His tone was too confident.
"Do you mean to try to force me?" Margaret countered.
She looked at Beauclair.
"You, who set the world on this course in search of justice for your daughter, you would seek to imprison me for the crime of being my father's daughter?"
"There are many," said Nemain, "who would rather be elsewhere. But we are few, child, too few to survive a war, no matter what some say. We have to make a show of strength. We need you in order to survive."
Margaret raised her head and squared her shoulders.
"Do you know what I learned when I was trapped in the earth for more than half a century, with neither food to eat nor water to drink nor light to see by? When there is no sound except that you make yourself, some things become very clear. Death is not to be feared. Death is easy. It is living that is brutal. The Fae may survive or not. I do not care. I am not one of you except through my parents. And they are both dead."
Garau reached across the table with the speed of a striking snake and slapped something on Margaret's wrist that closed with a click. A fine silver bar bracelet with a red cabochon stone. Garau held a similar bracelet and shut it on his wrist. As he clicked it closed, he drew in a breath as if it had hurt. Margaret sat frozen. It wasn't one of the set of bone cuffs, peace and quiet, that had once been used on me. Tad had destroyed those.
"If you cannot be persuaded any other way," the Widow Queen said, "then you leave us no choice.
We owe it to your father to protect you and return you to health.
Margaret looked down at her wrist. Then she looked at Garau.
You have made a mistake.
I couldn't help but look at Thomas. He was very, very still.
Perhaps, said Garau. I did argue that there were those who might be of more use to us. We have only one artifact that can hold a Fae against their will for very long.
You are so arrogant, all of you, Margaret said. Garau, Kostenin's son, you may be powerful, I do not contest that. But it has been a long time since you beheaded your uncle, and that you did after he was already defeated. But these bracelets are not about how powerful your magic is. You have made a mistake.
The name Kostenin rang a bell. Margaret focused on the bald little Fae. She said,
Crawl across the table to me.
Kostenin had been a shepherd who had 24 children. I remember that because it was twice 12, and 12 is a number that occurs quite a lot in fairy tales. Garau opened his mouth, then lost his smirk. He braced himself on the edge of the table.
Crawl, Margaret said.
All but one of Kostenin's children had been killed by a giant, Kostenin's brother. The single son who remained was named Garau. Slowly, very slowly, sweating and shaking, the Fae boosted himself up onto the table and crawled. The bracelet made a scratchy sound as he dragged it across the gleaming cherry finish of the table. He bit his lip, and blood dripped from it onto the wood. There must have been some sort of protocol at work, because none of the other Fae in the room gave him any aid. They stayed in their seats and watched Garau struggle. The Widow Queen looked mildly amused. The middle-aged woman took out a file and became engrossed in buffing her nails with vicious, jerky movements. Nemain and Beauclair looked as though they were competing for who could look the most relaxed. Unseen by the other Fae because of her position at the wall behind them, Edith smiled at Margaret, lifted a finger to her tongue to wet it, then drew an imaginary point in the air. If Margaret reacted, I couldn't tell. I'm not sure she even saw Edith's gesture. Margaret was engrossed in the strange battle she was engaged in with Garau. According to the Mabinogion, the Garau who was Kostenin's son had traveled with King Arthur and his knights, eventually returning to his home and killing the giant, his uncle. He was a hero, unless I'd gotten the story wrong, because the Garau in this room didn't look at all like a hero. When the unheroic Fae arrived at Margaret's side of the table, she reached out and grasped his wrist. As soon as she touched it, a thin red line began drawing itself across the plain silver of Garau's bracelet. It began slowly. Then, as Garau breathed in quick pants, moved more and more quickly, drawing glyphs that became part of more complex patterns until the bracelet was nearly solid red. Margaret sat back in her chair, took the bracelet off her wrist, and caught the other as it fell off Garau. She tossed both of them to Z. It broke the effect of the light glamour we'd all been wearing. Garau scrambled backward off the table, half falling in his effort to get away, not from Margaret, but from Z. The middle-aged woman dropped her file, and the Widow Queen froze. Uncle Mike smiled, and so did Beauclair. Nemain kept her relaxed pose, but then she'd known who was in the room the whole time. I glanced over at Z, who had his happy face on again. It was just wrong to see a happy face on Z.
Hello, Garau, Z said. Interesting to see you once more. I'm sure we'll meet under different circumstances. I'm looking forward to it.
He looked at the Widow Queen.
But not as much as I'm looking forward to some other meetings. You look more pale than you did the last time I saw you, Newth, he said.
He looked at the middle-aged woman who was frozen in her seat, and his smile grew brighter. He said nothing at all to her. The Widow Queen I knew hadn't been one of the Fae who tortured Z. I thought that Garau was in the clear, too, though they were not allies. Garau was afraid of Z, but there hadn't been any particular maliciousness in Z's voice when he addressed him. The middle-aged-looking woman was a dead Fae walking. We came to provide protection to Margaret and her guard who are traveling through our territory, said my husband, breaking into Z's moment with a conversational tone. We thought we'd use this opportunity to express our sadness at the death of the troll yesterday. Please do not send Faye, who put the citizens of our home at risk. We do not enjoy killing for the sake of killing.
Adam's sense of timing is superb. The Grey Lords, even the ones who had nothing to fear from Z, were so caught up in that drama they had trouble shifting gears to Adam. Their distraction let Adam hold the floor.
We'd also like to inform you that we are unimpressed with threats. Some of your people, he looked over the Fae at the table, except for the Widow Queen, composed a letter and put it on the door of my ex-wife's home. Please see to it that it doesn't happen again.
He took in a breath. And when he continued, it was in a very soft voice.
We do not want a war with you, but we will not stand by and see our friends captured and tortured. We will not allow you to harm those under our protection. You should know that the fire-touched boy is ours. We will go to war if you force us to it. And if we go to war, it will not stay localized. It will not stay between your people and ours, because our human citizens will fight beside us.
Z tossed the bracelets up in the air and caught them, one in each hand, and closed his fists. Air left my lungs, driven by the magic, he called. His hands glowed with a white light that was so bright I had to turn my face away. I fought to breathe, fought to stay on my feet, and it was gone. Z dropped two blackened chunks of metal on the table.
Those, he said, were an abomination.
How is it, murmured Beauclair, that you are not on our council, that you are not a Grey Lord?
No one asked me, said Z.
Join us, said Nemaine.
Z smiled at the Grey Lord who sat on the far side of the Widow Queen, the one in the salmon-colored suit. She swallowed noisily.
Not today, Z said, his voice a purr of menace. I have a few scores to settle. And I take too much pleasure in the planning to hurry. I'm swamped.
I've got my country's 500th anniversary to plan, my wedding to arrange, my wife to murder, and Gilder to frame for it, I murmured very quietly. I wasn't sure that Z was quoting the movie, but he sounded so much like Prince Humperdinck I couldn't help myself. Either Adam was the only one who heard me, or no one else appreciated the Princess Bride.
So, said Margaret, pushing herself back from the table, you have my answer.
This time she let Thomas help her to her feet and hand her the crutches.
Not that it hasn't been interesting, but you'll understand that if you want to discuss anything with me, you'll have to do it long distance.
She made good time out of the room, and we followed her. As soon as I shut the conference room door, Thomas picked Margaret up in his arms. I took the crutches. As the least able fighter, I could most easily be spared to carry things, and the crutches would make pretty good weapons if I needed them. The bride and her entourage were gone when we got back to the lobby. One of the hotel people saw us get out of the elevator, and upon seeing Margaret in Thomas's arms, hurried over.
Is there anything I can do? He asked.
No, Margaret said with a charming smile. Thomas was either worried that I've tired myself out, or just wanted to get out to the car sometime in the next hour or so.
Her tone told him not to take her seriously, and he smiled appreciatively before he got a good look at Thomas's unamused face.
Don't mind him, Margaret said. He worries too much.
We have a wheelchair, the young man offered.
Thank you, said Thomas, bowing a little despite his burden, though he kept walking in the direction of the exit. This is not the first time I've carried her out to the car. She pushes herself too hard, even though I've explained that when she does that, she only slows down the healing process.
The hotel employee looked worried.
I should recover fully, Margaret told him, given time. It's just a lot of boring therapy between now and then. Tonight I really am fine, just a little tired.
He escorted us out to the front entrance, offered to drive the car up, and when his help was refused, held the door open for us to leave. We'd gotten halfway across the dark parking lot when Adam murmured,
Someone is watching us. I can feel it on the back of my neck.
I bent down to tie my shoe,
and took the opportunity to scan the parking lot behind us. The nice guy who escorted us out is still watching us. Is that it?
She affects a lot of people that way, said Thomas, as Margaret waved at our observer over his shoulder.
It's the tragedy, said Margaret cheerfully. Some people can't stop themselves from wanting to help. It's a compulsion.
The man waved hesitantly back and left the doorway for the depths of the hotel, presumably to do his job.
That's not it, said Adam in a low voice. Let's get to the cars.
I don't scent anyone, I said after finishing with my shoe. But I'm with you. There's someone.
They're around, agreed Thomas.
Margaret leaned her head against him.
This would be a perfect time for an ambush, she said, sounding delighted. Maybe there's a troll or ogre around.
How about a witch? Asked a woman's voice.
As soon as she spoke, I saw her, a young, muscular woman wearing a summer dress with brown army boots, walking beside Margaret and Thomas as if she'd been beside us all along.
9.
As soon as she appeared, I could smell her. Her scent held a mix of cinnamon, brimstone, and honey, but no witchcraft. She smelled like a fae, but with overtones of earth and water rather than a clear allegiance to either, which was unusual in my experience. Thomas jumped 10 feet sideways, Margaret in his arms. Adam moved in front of them like a trained bodyguard. I recognized her scent and stopped my instinctive move to draw my carry gun. Instead, like Adam, I put myself in front of Thomas and Margaret. Z stood where he was, but put a hand on his hip, where I knew he kept one of his bladed weapons. He didn't just use magic swords, he made them.
Dangerous to surprise us like that, he said coolly, because he, of course, knew who it was.
I did, too. It's not that I remember everyone I sent. It's just that some people make a definite impression. Though some of the Fae have favorite glamours they wear, visual impressions are not a definitive way to recognize a Fae. Scent is much more difficult for them to change.
What's life without a little danger?
The woman looked at me and said,
And didn't I tell them to keep an eye on you? No one who carries coyote so strongly is going to be resting on the sidelines, but they never listen to me.
Thomas set Margaret on her feet. You aren't a witch, I said. I'd been as surprised as anyone when I met Baba Yaga the first time. The most famous witch in the world wasn't.
She shrugged. You say tomato and I say tomato.
She used the phrase backward, the second tomato carrying the long A.
A million people and 100 tails can't be wrong. You say fae, I say witch, and I am bigger than you, so I can call myself what I want.
She leaned toward me and sniffed and twitched her nose in a very unhuman-like way.
There's a Russian here, she said to me. I can always tell, and it's not you.
She took a wide, awkward, sideways step until she was in front of Z. She frowned at Z a moment.
I remember you as better looking.
I remember you as an old topfkooker who sticks her long nose where it doesn't belong, said Z, unimpressed.
She dropped her head and cackled, a real witch's cackle, as if she'd watched too many cartoons.
There's my loan, darling. Oops, I forgot. You are calling yourself Zibold Adalbertsmeiter now, aren't you? Adalbert was such an old stick in the mud. He deserved what he got. But he was a wimp. No one I'd brag about smiting. Zibold, darling, have you missed me? You never call, you never write. A person would be forgiven for thinking you didn't like them. You certainly aren't my Russian.
She looked at Thomas, put a hand on Z's shoulder so she could lean past him to sniff the air.
Not you, she told Margaret.
She looked at Thomas and said,
Obviously not you. Too much earth dragon, too little air of the step.
She took that odd sidestep again. This time it put her directly in front of Adam. She leaned too close to him and inhaled.
So, it is you, she exclaimed with the air of a vaudeville cop finding the villain.
She waited a moment, relaxed, and said,
You smell of my home. True Ruski Duke, I should take you home for supper. I would have just a few centuries ago. Sharpen my brass tooth in your honor. Silver would be more appropriate, but I broke that one in 1916.
The brass tooth threw me for a moment. Then I remembered that Baba Yaga was supposed to eat people with metal teeth that she would take out of her mouth and sharpen in front of her victims. In the stories I'd heard, the teeth were supposed to be iron, not brass. Baba Yaga had not slowed down her patter, though.
More to the point, she said, then giggled. Point tooth, do you get it? I am so funny. But, as I was saying, I am civilized now. Tamed for the sake of the others, you know. A fine, handsome man as you, now I take him home for other things.
She licked her lips hungrily. Adam growled at her. Stop it, I said to her, because I was afraid that if she kept talking, someone would make a stupid move and get themselves killed. Everyone's on edge. There's no use pushing them over. What do you want?
Who are you? Asked Margaret.
The witch, who was a gray lord, took the sides of her sundress, one side in each hand, and curtsied.
Baba Yaga, at your... well, not at your service, that would be a lie. Say rather, I'm not opposed to you, or not as opposed to you as I am to some others who are in the hotel tonight.
She dropped her skirt and held up a hand, displaying a business card with a cartoon Baba Yaga figure on it and a phone number.
For if they bother you, dearling, just give us a ring. They being the other Grey Lords, of course.
She dropped the silliness for a moment.
Margaret, I owed your father, and he cannot collect. Take the card. Put it in the bottom of a drawer somewhere, but remember it. When you need me, you can call the number or rip the card in half, and I will come to your aid once.
Margaret put her hand on Thomas to steady herself, and walked a few steps forward so she could take it.
My father told me stories about you, she said. He spoke well of you, mostly.
Baba Yaga smiled, her teeth white and straight.
How good of him. I speak well of him, too, mostly.
She looked at me.
I like what you're doing, coyote girl, even though you had to kill my favorite troll. That's not your fault, though. I know who sent him. They are claiming they forgot how strong the call of water would be on him, that it was an accident that they lost control. You and I know better.
She held out another card, this one poison green.
You don't get to call upon me for a favor, she said when I took it.
She glanced at Adam and licked her lips again.
Not unless you want to share the Russian wolf.
No, I said, closing my fist on the card so it crumpled into a ball. She cackled again and said,
if you rip that one up, it will just be harder to read. You should call me for information. I think you might need advice soon. And I will call upon you from time to time. No obligation on either side, of course. You don't have to tell me anything, nor do I have to tell you anything. But I don't want a war with the humans, and some idiot among us, or more properly, some idiots among us, are determined to start one. If I know trouble is coming your way, I'll tell you. Keep that card. You'll need it soon.
All right, I said slowly. No promises implied or given. She smiled.
Just so.
And she disappeared. No mortar and pestle this time. She was just gone. Her scent lingered behind her.
That's all right, then, said Margaret. We needed a finale.
Don't trust her, Z told me.
He looked at Margaret.
You're probably all right if you're cautious.
I am, she said, tucking the card into the small handbag she'd been carrying. And if I'm not cautious enough, Thomas is happy to point it out.
She looked at me.
Mercy, I really would like a chance to talk to you. Would you mind driving our car?
She gave her hands a rueful look.
I'm getting better, but my hands aren't trustworthy to drive yet. Thomas? Would you mind riding with Adam?
The answer I saw on Thomas's face was that he minded very much, but he said,
I can do that.
Sure, I said. We'll have a girl's car and a guy's car. It'll be fun. Thomas picked Margaret up and put her in her seat and watched gravely while she belted herself in.